Mountain is brought to you by OutKit. If you're running a charity or organisation that's helping folk get outdoors, but you're short of funds, then please consider the OutKit Foundation. You might be struggling to find cash for equipment, transport or staff training. A foundation grant could pay for any of these things.
Okay, so I'm Lindsay Cannon-Potts and I'm the head of fundraising here at the Neuromuscular Centre.
Lindsay's centre used a grant to help young people with muscular dystrophy get outside on bushcraft days. These are children who are quite often told, no, you can't do that, but not here.
The school holidays in particular can be quite challenging for young people with the condition because perhaps they can't access the same summer activities that their peer group can. We deliver accessible bushcraft and forestry skills courses. All of those kinds of outdoor activities would typically be believed to be inaccessible. We've managed to make them brilliantly accessible.
All with the help of an OutKit Foundation grant. Find out how you could apply for one at alpkit.com. That's alpkit.com. And thank you very much to OutKit for supporting Mountain. Right, we're just over this. Get over this fence. And where are we headed from here, John?
Well, just up to these trees.
This is really to keep people away from this area, this ridge, and then the fence was put up because although people are supposed to keep away from the entrance, you know, inevitably if there's vehicles up here, sometimes they'll park a bit too close. So we're just going to head up.
This is John Haddo. For almost 40 years, John's been the warden of this rather strange wildlife reserve.
There is a sort of path through the trees.
And we're sort of wading through snow today as well. Ooh, first snow in quite a while. John and I are on a mountain in central Scotland. It's probably a bit too small to call a mountain really, but it's high enough to have caught some of the first hill snow of the winter. And John's taking me to a cave entrance, which unless you knew it was there, would be almost impossible to find.
This is the entrance. That was blocked off by this grill, 1972.
We're in, I guess it's like a sort of quarry feature, and hidden behind some trees is this sort of hobbit-style entrance. It's like a little archway in it, and it's barred up, and then overhanging it are the heather and bracken and things like that, easily missed. But yeah, as with any tunnel, when you look at an entrance, however much you don't like going underground, there's always a bit of you that thinks, what's in there? What's in there?
Okay.
Right, so we're going to get our helmets on, are we? In?
Yeah.
All that gear.
Helmets and torches.
Helmets and torches. This isn't a natural cave. It's a man-made tunnel. And it was built by men who lived very close by, just a couple of hundred metres away, in a village on the side of this mountain.
See if we can open the padlock.
A small village that appeared out of nothing at the end of one century, and then, halfway through the next, it disappeared. It lasted two, maybe three generations. A whole village just gone, and the tunnel abandoned. That's quite a small hole.
Well, the best way to get in is always to go in backwards, unless you're really athletic.
I'll take backwards. I'm Christopher Slight, and this is Mountain. Right, and that must be a view up there to some of the older workings, is it? Just that through, up
yes,
straight ahead of us.
See the
yeah.
Big point to pick up
there. I need to start this story above ground, in daylight. I have this habit when I'm wandering around the hills, and that's imagining what life must have been like for the people who lived and worked in these landscapes. People who left long ago because the world changed, or were forced to leave because the world changed for someone else. A few months ago, I was poking around a small, empty hill without a map and I stumbled across an old quarry. It was abandoned, but there was enough rock lying around to see it used to be a slate quarry. And that's where this story starts, with slate.
The slate here is also part of a line of slate that runs across the whole of Scotland.
That's Louis Stott, an author and local historian who knows all about this quarry.
I am the author of a book about the slate quarries in Aberfoyle. Very interesting.
Aberfoyle is a small village in central Scotland. In tourism speak, it's the gateway to the Trossachs, basically the village you stop off at for lunch or coffee before you head to Loch Katrin and Sir Walter Scott country. Even if you haven't been here, you've probably heard of the road that passes through the village. The A827, or Duke's Pass, is often blocked by snow in the winter and will get a mention on BBC Radio traffic reports. It's that road that Louis and I are looking down onto as we talk. But long before traffic reports, or the actual road, people have been nibbling away at the slate here.
There are some quite intriguing examples early on of people taking a lot of trouble to get slate from Aberfoyle. There's a UV church in Buckleivery, and it was rebuilt, and I think it was 1752, something like that. And the roof needed doing. And so the minister called the parishioners together and said, right, next Sunday we're going to Aberfoyle, bring a horse, and every one of you is to come. And they eventually came here with pack horses, won the slate, and carried it back to roof their church. Quite an elaborate and difficult operation, but I suppose if you've got a minister threatening to send you to hell, you get on with it.
It's a whole new angle on the church roof appeal, that is, isn't it?
That's exactly right.
It's likely slate has been quarried here, on and off, since the 1500s. But for a really long time, it was simply too hard to move it anywhere.
Aberfoyle was really quite a difficult place to mine slate, because you'd know where to move it until you got quite a long way from the quarries. Whereas Ballachulish, for example, or Easedale, two places in the West Highlands which are rich in slate, they're right on the seafront. Quarry the slate, into a boat, off you go to Glasgow or wherever. So it's only recently that the full-scale mining quarrying operation started up here from about the 1880s.
Suddenly it became a viable business. So why did that happen?
Well, it's undoubtedly due to the railway. I think the maximum number of people ever recorded in the census as slate quarriers was 20 during the whole of the 1840s to 1880. It then went up to about 100, and it was transformed largely because a company was formed to build a railway and to extract slate. It's almost as if you couldn't quite make up your mind, was it the slate quarries wanting to get the slate out, or was it the railways wanting to expand the slate quarries? They both grew very rapidly.
The railway brought profit and many more workers. Lots of them came from the slate island of Easedale, as the quarry there had been flooded in a huge storm. Others arrived from Ballachulish quarry after a long disagreement with the owner and a 12-month lockout. The workers and their families built that village at the foot of the quarry, the Aberfoyle Cotteries, as it was called, basically to shorten their daily commute. But it became this self-contained community right next to the Duke's Pass Road, with streets, a school, a guild, even a co-op. There were houses for families and a hostel for unmarried men. What sort of jobs were available in a quarry like this? There presumably would have been lots of tasks to do. What were the worst ones, and what were the better jobs you could get in a quarry?
Well, the most skilled person was a slate maker, and he would be working up here to shape the slate finally into what we call tiles. Before that, a splitter would have taken the big wedges of slate that came out of the hill and got them into a better sort of shape, a rough shape. However, quarries were mined by family groups, and the main man was always the face man, and he was the one who, of course, stuck the explosive in, and they put a little bit in, and then a little bit more, a little more, and then finally away came a big face of the quarry cliff. And he was always in charge of the group, because of course his product was what kept the whole thing going.
And so, if he got it wrong, it was expensive.
Absolutely.
Was it dangerous work?
It depends what you call dangerous. I think there were one or two deaths up here, but not very many. Not as dangerous as coal mining, for example.
It's actually a fascinating landscape that we're looking at the moment, because we're sort of standing right on the raw edge of it here, the jagged tooth, and we can see all the spoil spilling. But the further you push back into the quarry, the more that nature has sort of taken back over, and you're seeing sort of trees rooting and lots of moss and grass and heather growing over. And then right in the distance, about as far as we can see, it's like a shapely peak, a mini Matterhorn, which I guess is like the skeleton of the workings there. It's just the bit they've left there.
Yes. It's a very interesting quarry. That's, I think, called the West Quarry, the one where they've got the peak. And it's the most recently opened. Interestingly, one of the quarries here is called the Klondike Quarry. Now that's, of course, to remind us that anybody who had any sense in mining went off to get gold rather than hanging out trying to quarry slate.
The quarry was busy for 70 years, but the slate became harder to win just as demand began to fall, and then the railway closed. At some point in the 1950s, no one's exactly sure when, the last piece of slate was quarried and the workers abandoned their village. But although the top half of this quarry, the bit I stumbled across, is disused, a small part of it is still worked. It's owned by the Forestry Commission, and if you want to visit officially, you need to be escorted by someone with a quarry passport.
I'm Anne Gilchrist and I work for Forestry Commission Scotland in Aberfoyle. My role is the Community and Visitor Services Manager within the Queen Elizabeth Forest Park.
What happens here now, Anne?
We still use some of the material from the quarry. It's predominantly used as a base material for forest roads, provide access to extract the commercial timber out of the forest.
Should we go and have a look at some of this slate just here? Because there are still an awful lot of quite large chunks lying around. And what always fascinates me about slate is just the variation in the colour. Because just picking up these two bits here, we've got this
greys and greens and lilacs.
But just within like a metre of us, this one's almost pink. This is a beautiful, almost verdigris green.
And I think that's why it's so popular now. You see people put it in their houses and they have either slate worktops or they have them on the floor or, you know, maybe in a shower room they'll have a slate base unit.
Can I take a piece?
You can take a little bit, yes, I'm sure that will fit
a little bit. I'm not
fit
planning
in your pocket, it'll be fine.
I'm not planning on bringing the vehicle up here or anything. No. I do quite like this, although it's friable.
Yes.
It's a beautiful colour.
The lilac. Mm-hmm. I often find when I'm driving over the Duke's Pass on a wet day, and you look across at the Slate Quarry, you can see all the different colours. It's a fascinating place, and any time I've been up here, it always seems to be on a misty day, and it's kind of ethereal, and it just has an atmosphere all of its own. Although I imagine back in the 1800s and you're working in that, it would be cold, horrible, wet conditions.
We're being watched, Anna.
Yes, I know. There's a pair of ravens here. It's just, they're like ghosts. I always feel up here as though I'm being watched. It's just part of the atmosphere.
You really feel that? You feel that sense of sort of, yeah, of history?
Yes, I do. I'm up here.
They're actually bigger birds than you realise, aren't
they?
Yeah,
ravens are big. Yes, huge. They're different shaped beaks than, you know, the smaller carrion crows.
You say it was making the hairs on the back of your neck stand up.
Yes, it was. I just always feel when I'm up here, someone's watching me. And it just feels as though you can transport yourself back to the 1800s and that history is here.
That day in the quarry, I didn't feel like I was surrounded by ghosts. I didn't feel the sensation of being watched. Perhaps because nature has moved back in as it does, and much of the quarry looks like a natural landscape now. And then, a few weeks later, I met up with John Haddo, and we went underground.
Oh, got my head already. It's really low. So we're wading right into the heart of the quarry now. I guess that the water's not quite welly height, just underneath. It's pretty clear, but we're stirring up this silt. And I had to duck down at first, but I can stand up now. It's in an almost perfect arc. It's been carved or blasted out. I can sort of reach across with my arms and touch both walls. Amazing place. Wow.
So we're in the large chamber now, which opens up after about 30 metres.
Tell me, what was this tunnel put in for? What was its function in the quarry?
It was built to carry a small railway and small trucks that would take the slate material away. And what we've got here are actually stacks of the rough slate that would have been put into these trucks and taken away. And this has been sitting here since it became disused. Could be as late as the 1950s, or it could be earlier than that these were actually put there.
One of the things about Aberfoyle Slate Quarry is that the workers were pretty untidy. They didn't pay much attention to where they put the spoil. And as they quarried further into the hill, it became harder and harder to get the slate out. There were mountains of rubble everywhere to get around. So they blasted this passage to access the faces at the back of the quarry. The quarried slate was dropped into trucks and wheeled through the tunnel on rails that eventually linked up with the mainline station in Aberfoyle.
You can see, particularly as we go along the deeper part of the tunnel, you can see the remains of the old sleepers.
So every couple of feet.
Yeah, you can see the old wood there, pretty rotten now, or you'll just see, you know, the depression where the wood was. I can show you some of the shot holes, say for example here. So there and there, there are lots of shot holes and they're angled in different directions. So these would be drilled out and then explosives put into them and this is blasted. And in the walls at the side, you'll see every so often there's a wooden plug which would have been used to hold a lamp of some sort.
And how long is the tunnel?
From here, it's just over 100 metres to the far end. It would have been open originally when the quarry was being worked, but it's filled up with debris, so it's closed.
So as fascinating as it is to explore all this sort of industrial heritage underneath here, it's not why you're here. Why do you come into this tunnel?
I come in to look for the bats.
John is a wildlife consultant and the chairman of Central Scotland Bat Group. He's been looking after this tunnel since 1978 and has spent a lot of time down here in the dark.
We, as a bat group, do a visit to this tunnel generally only once or maybe twice in the winter. We know that bats are most likely to be found hibernating here in January and February.
And how many bats and how many species?
Well, we get three species: Natter's bat, DeBenton's bat, and long-eared bat, brown long-eared bat. And we're lucky to get six bats in total if we find bats. That's the sort of numbers we're talking about. They are quite difficult to see, and they can be in places that we just don't find them. So when we say there's six bats, there could be twice as many, and they're just hiding in crevices and we just don't find them. So we are finding them in the more obvious places.
As they're hibernating, presumably we need to be really careful about not disturbing them.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the reasons why we only visit this place once or twice in the winter, because we don't want to disturb them, we don't want to waken them up.
So we've got 100 metres or so of tunnel, maybe half a dozen bats. We're going to go on a bit of a bat hunt. We're going to creep around, and if we see one, well, we can move away and talk about it somewhere else, basically.
Yeah. It's best not to linger too long beside the bat. But the main thing is to watch your head, because the height of this tunnel the rest of the way is, just head hitting height.
Okay, let's go on a bat hunt.
Okay. You see, there's some of the timbers that have been put out of the way.
Fabulously aged, isn't it? Look at that.
Yeah. I mean, that must be 100 years old anyway.
Just casually lent against the side of the rock there.
So nobody's done anything to this tunnel since it's been a bat reserve. So anything that you see is more or less as it was. We haven't moved anything.
There is a weird sense of abandonment. Like you were saying, with the slates all stacked out ready to go, a piece of timber just lying here. Like they just thought, right, we're closing the quarry, and out they went, and that was it.
Yeah. When you measure the humidity here, it's something like 95%, which is, again, very good for the bats, because otherwise they'll dry out. Sometimes you'll actually see beads of moisture.
Is that a bat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's our first one. Nicely spotted. It's actually in one of these short holes, just as I was saying. Now, actually, that's interesting. This is a brown long-eared bat. It has these huge ears, which are as long as its body. But when it's hibernating, when it's at rest, when it's torpid, it tucks its big ears underneath its wings. So all that you see is a sort of pointy thing, which is called a tragus. It's like the bit in the middle of your ear.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. This little furry creature is filling this shot hole, and then there are just these little pointy bits and a tiny face.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the wider one. So you can stand up a bit more.
Finally stretch my back.
Yeah. So there's another bat. This time it's a Natter's bat.
As we creep along in the dark, we manage to spot two more bats, one wedged in a gap in the slate, the other just clinging to a vertical wall. And then we reach the end of the tunnel.
And are we at the end of the cave here? So this cave just ends suddenly in a pile of rubble. So presumably it would go on and up, but it's just full of spoil.
From looking at what it's like above ground, if you like, I think this just went into a ravine. I think it was open at the top, but this is just the spoil that's filling it now. What you can see lying around are pieces of scrap iron.
Oh, they've sort of been chunky nuts and bolts.
This must have been some sort of winding wheel, and you can see there's a rail just propped up against the wall.
Sort of Mary Celeste feel.
Yeah.
It's quite spooky in a way. I know you're a man of science, but do you ever sort of feel the presence of those people that work these spaces when you're in them doing your work?
I wouldn't say I do. I mean, I'm conscious of them in terms of the size, because obviously these tunnels were dug to fit these sort of workers. You know, they made them big enough they could get through comfortably, and generally we find that. They probably weren't as tall as the average man or woman is these days. So from that point of view, yeah, you know, you can't help but thinking about them when you see some bits of iron. You wonder what they were used for. You see the plugs in the wall that must have held lanterns. You know, what sort of lanterns were they? What were they doing? What was their day like? All that sort of thing. Yeah, it does go through your mind. Although most of the time I'm concentrating on the bats, I have to say.
Should we leave these bats in peace for the rest of their hibernation and head to daylight?
Good idea. Let's go.
Here we are, back at the entrance.
Bumping my head.
Out into the snow. Wow, I've got a leaky boot.
Have you?
Definitely.
Oh dear.
I could have left you with the ghosts. The neatly stacked slate that was never loaded, or the tunnel built just right for a 19th century quarry worker. An abandoned village and a world changed. But there's one cottage left on Duke's Pass, a last fragment of the village. It's the foreman's cottage, built to a much higher standard than the rest of the houses, and still lived in today.
Hi, Cindy, how are you doing?
I saw you, but it wasn't even easy to get a Porsche vehicle.
Yeah, like everything. It's the only way you can get up there.
There's a kettle just boils.
So I'm sat now in Hill Cottage in the front room with a pretty welcome cup of tea because it was so cold out there, with Cindy McLaughlin, who's lived here for
7 years now.
So you've been here 7 years, but this cottage has actually been in your family for a lot longer than that.
Yes, my mum and dad first bought it in 1987 from the Forestry Commission. It was very derelict at the time. And then we spent 3 years as a family doing it up every weekend with my dad very much the lead, making it into a holiday home.
What drew your parents to it, though? Had they just driven past it and thought, that's an interesting looking place. I wonder if we could go and buy that.
I think, as most people know, Duke's Pass is one of the most scenic drives in, dare I say, Scotland, or certainly in central Scotland anyway. And it makes you feel a little bit like you're in the middle of nowhere, even though you're only an hour from Glasgow, an hour from Edinburgh. And it does have a feel of wilderness about it. And I think to see a little lone cottage sitting there by itself has an attraction to anybody.
It's all very well, I guess, as a holiday cottage, but, you know, you're here full time and you've got a young family and you're completely off the grid. No water, no electric, no phone line. Why did you decide, yeah, this is the place I want to come and live, in that lonely house on the hill?
Oh, well, it wasn't an easy decision, and it was one we didn't take lightly, because I don't think people recognise how hard it is to live without mains electricity and to be responsible for it yourself. Even things like a washing machine, you know, it took us a long time to get our system set up. So, you know, we did think about it very, very carefully. And I suppose you wouldn't want to go into living somewhere like this with a light work ethic.
But it, I mean, it's a wild, cold place in winter, and you're on a road that is quite often closed.
The road has been a huge issue. The road historically is never treated, and it's really hard for us, even with snow chains and a 4x4. So goodness only knows how it was for the villagers who were maybe walking up and down all through winter time up a really steep road and a steep incline. But yeah, oh, we always think of the village up here and how hard it must have been for them. We've been very lucky to speak to some people who've come up and told us their stories of living up here when they were children and adults working up here. And it sounds like it was a really hard life for them, a really, really cold, hard life. I heard stories about the mothers used to do the washing in the burn, and they used to wash downstream in the burn so not to get the drinking supply dirty. So although I complain that it's very hard to do my washing on a generator, it was nothing compared to how these guys lived.
Do you feel like a strong connection to the old village and the people that live there?
Well, we do, you know, and we feel very, very lucky that we've been able to keep this house alive. I think when my dad and mum bought it, it was on the verge of going downhill and becoming part of the rubble pile as well. So, you know, we feel very lucky and privileged to have been able to build it up and make it a useful family home again. And actually the new structure that we've built, our new garage next to the house, we've called it Tarry Row in memory of one of the rows of houses that used to be up here. I believe there was a stony row, a wood row and a tarry row.
It's quite nice in a way that you're raising a family here and you run a business from here as well, that there's still this spark of life left in the Cotteries.
Oh, it's lovely, and hopefully it will always remain. People have an interest here in Aberfoyle in the slate quarries, and I think people in the village are happy that they come up, they visit, they see the house and they're glad to see it being used. And for a family to be raised up here is very, very special. I think our children maybe don't appreciate quite at the moment how lucky they are to have the freedom and the countryside and the nature that they've got, but hopefully they will in the future, because it is a very special place.
Cindy McLaughlin. A massive thanks to Cindy, Louis Stott, Anne Gilchrist and John Haddo. Louis' book is called Aberfoyle Slate Quarries, Fragments of an Earlier World, and it's published by Stirling Council. Thanks also to Hugh Williams for editing help and our sponsor, Alpkit. Music for this episode was from Blue Dot Sessions, Dexter Britton, Poddington Bear, Wineland and Lee Roosevelt. More details on our website, which is mountainpodcast.com. Go there to hear all our past episodes and for links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. If you enjoyed an episode, please tweet about it or share it on Facebook or leave a review on iTunes. It really helps other people find us. Thank you and thanks for listening today. I'm Christopher Slate, and this is Mountain.